Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David Dry, and today we have the pleasure to be talking with Maurice Crandall about his new book, These People Have Always Been a Republic, Indigenous Electorates in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands, 1598 to 1912, published in 2019 by the University of North Carolina Press. This history traces how the Hopis, Pueblos, Tohono O'odhums, and Yaquis in the southwestern borderlands refused, incorporated, and adapted to political structures of successful colonial regimes from 1598 to 1912, as they sought to preserve their autonomy and eternal systems of governments over their land and people. Maurice Crandall, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
I wonder if you could start things off by telling us a little about yourself and your background as a scholar.
Sure. So I am, first of all, I'm a citizen of the Yavapai Apache Nation of Camp Verde, Arizona. We are an indigenous nation that's relatively small. We have somewhere around, actually, I'm not sure the population figures exactly right now. They hover around 3,000 or so. And, you know, it's a small group. It's a relatively small community there in central Arizona. And we are bicultural, so made up of Yavapais, who are human speakers, and then Apaches, who are Athabascan speakers. So not culturally related groups, but because of proximity and areas in which we have resided since time immemorial, it ended up that the federal government put us on not a single reservation, because we actually have several pieces of non-contiguous reservation land, but in a single tribal unit, let's say. And then we went through the Indian reorganization period in the 1930s. So that's my tribal background. I got my PhD at the University of New Mexico in history. So I'm trained as a historian. I teach at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, in the Native American Studies program. But I teach primarily history courses, but we're an interdisciplinary program. So there's a lot of working in collaboration with other scholars, indigenous scholars from different fields, and working in it, you know, in that interdisciplinary model, which is, it's nice, you know, to have that experience of seeing other disciplines within Native American studies, you know, from science to philosophy to English and literature and history and all of this, how it comes together. That's been great. And I've, you know, a relatively new professor in terms of my time as a professional scholar. You know, I have a passion for history, the history of indigenous peoples of my region, which is what we would call the American Southwest, in New Mexico, Arizona, Northern Mexico, that region around the U.S.-Mexico border, as it is today, so those are where my passions are. In that, I'm, you know, I'm a desert person. I love the Southwest and the heat. So living in New England is a little bit different for me, but that's what I do.
Wonderful. Thank you. And you can really see the passion in this book. This is, a remarkably ambitious book. As was mentioned, it looks at indigenous electorates over a 300-year period, 3 colonial regimes, 4 different native nations. And so I wonder if you could speak to, what you sought to accomplish with each of those different categories, electorates over time, multiple colonial governments, and the comparative aspect of looking at different native nations. Because I think really the sum is greater than the parts, but you've really taken on also a lot of parts here.
Sure. Yeah. I'll kind of start by saying it's funny that I had to kind of trim this down even. I mean, I had initially envisioned this to be an even larger project, going well into the 20th and potentially into the 21st century, carrying it to contemporary times. But fortunately, I trimmed that down because that would have been even more difficult to manage. What I really wanted to do was show that a view of democracy, politics, voting, elections within Indigenous communities necessarily needs to go back a lot further than has typically been done. So when we talk about Native American voting, most people think of elections within the U.S. system. The Native vote. There are initiatives each election cycle to get Native peoples to vote, to go to the polls, particularly in states where they make up a significant block of voters. And so sometimes our view of Native American voting can be a little bit narrow. And that's how I always sort of understood it. And I have, my relatives have always been in tribal politics. And so I was always familiar with and part of tribal elections and knowing who's up for election, for council, for chair, and all the various positions. And so I sort of had a view of electoral processes that was very U.S. centric. And as I got into this topic, I realized very quickly that it had to go back much further. It had to include previous systems of electoral politics in order to get a more realistic view. And as you go back into the 19th century, into the 18th century, into the 17th, you realize that the history of Indigenous voting in that region that I focus on, it goes much, much further back than the United States and electoral politics and constitutional amendments and Voting Rights Act. I mean, all of those things are important, but the history of Indigenous voting and electorates goes back to the Spanish period, if we're talking about the colonial context. And so you really have to start with colonial mandates during Spain, during the period in which Spain was the colonizer in the Southwest. And then you see how that influences future electoral developments within Indigenous communities, that those influences are still felt very strongly in some of the communities that I look at, and some of those political mandates are still in place in some form. The comparative aspect was to show, look, this isn't a progressive narrative that we start with one colonial state and then we're moving up and and then finally we arrive at the United States, where a combination of Supreme Court decisions or lower court decisions in combination with congressional acts and things of that sort finally enfranchise Native peoples. That it just does not work that way. If you look at the evidence and the historical experiences of these communities, that Native peoples are enfranchised in a variety of ways and experience voting and enfranchisement and really sort of a roller coaster fashion. That there are ebbs and flows, and there's much resistance, there's accommodation, and then there's just indigenizing of institutions throughout those colonial periods. And so I wanted to get that wide view to see how that worked over, like you say, three centuries of history. So doing that, it has to necessarily be both broad and deep. So it, at times, you know, the narrative is very specific and looks at, some very specific contexts with individuals, and you see their actions. But then there is also a broader stroke in combination with that very personal and small. And it's difficult to do. You know, it was hard. It was a sort of a balancing act to cover a long period, but then also with the amount of detail, with the amount of stories and about individuals and about communities, to get the right combination. So, I tried. I think that in places it was successful, and others maybe not. No book is perfect, but that was what I attempted to do. And I hope that my hope was always that people who read this do get that larger sense and see a larger sweep of history and counter kind of hegemonic narratives that would privilege the United States as sort of the bastion of democracy and the colonial state that finally kind of lives up to the promise of enfranchising communities of color. What I found through my research was that was not the case. And so that's what I hope, really comes across in there. And that Native people don't always want enfranchisement or civil rights, as we might call them, that they want different things at different times. What they want most of all is autonomy, sovereignty, control of their own indigenous nations and communities.
Thank you. And, I think it's you really hits home. You open the book with a brief discussion of U.S. Representative Deb Haaland, a member of the Laguna Pueblo people, and, this tendency to potentially tell a triumphalist, 20th century narrative of expanding civil rights and enfranchisement. But by taking the scope that you do, you really see a very different story and the dangers of that colonial narrative. I want to talk about all of the different groups and their responses, but I wonder if you could start by giving us kind of an overview of the different colonial administrations. All of them have the end goal of elimination, but each of them kind of has a different strategy for pursuing it, and that provides opportunities for slippage between the intent of settler colonialism and its tangible outcomes. And so could you talk in somewhat general terms about the different colonial regimes, Spanish, Mexican, and American? Sure. So that we can kind of set the stage to talk about Native responses.
Yeah, absolutely. So Spain has a set of goals in their colonialism. I mean, certainly church and state go hand in hand, and we have any discussion of colonial Spain, we need to think about both the Catholic Church and the Spanish Crown. And you see it in the documents often referred to as the two sovereigns. And so when representatives of both the church and the Spanish state go into indigenous communities, they talk about how we want to make you subjects of the two sovereigns, which means the King of Spain and your Lord and King Jesus Christ. And so those two go hand in hand. I mean, that's important to start with that understanding. The missions in the communities that I look at, the missions do a lot of the work of colonialism. They do a lot of the heavy lifting because where indigenous peoples are more dispersed in communities that cover a wide landscape, they need to be brought in and congregated in missions. And so that work occurs at the missions. And often it's with the help, of course, of soldiers and representatives of the crown who help round up indigenous people and bring them into the missions. But at a place like the Pueblos in New Mexico, there were already in some places very concentrated communities where there were several hundred or even in the thousands of residents. And so missionization was a little, you know, I use easier in air quotes if you could see my hand right now. So the Spanish crown has this goal of missionizing indigenous communities and eventually turning them into self-sustaining, self-governing communities that would then become Spanish citizens and hopefully pay taxes like other communities of non-indigenous people within the Spanish realm. And missionization is supposed to be a short period to lead to that point. And Spain envisioned, you know, a 10-year period of missionization for communities, and then they could be transitioned into secular religious establishments and not missions with friars there who are there permanently. And when they did that, you know, they modeled these indigenous communities after Spanish towns so that they would have governing officials like a gobernador, a governor, and then you would have, you know, alcaldes and fiscales and a variety of officials who would oversee the governance of those communities. But these would be Indian officials. These would be indigenous peoples from those communities. And Spain envisioned elections that would accomplish this. There would be an annual election of officials, and people would actually go and into a community house and vote for these people. And among all the communities that I look at, things pan out quite differently, and each one tailors that election to its own needs. And sometimes it doesn't look anything like what Spain envisioned. But there's a degree of sort of give and take and allowance that lets these communities sort of move forward in their own way. And so that Spanish period lasts for a long time, and missionization takes much longer. It just, you know, it just keeps dragging on and on, whether they're Franciscan missions or Jesuit missions, depending on the location, who's doing the missionizing, what order of friars. You know, that period just keeps going and going and going. You know, well into the early part of the 19th century, leading into Mexican independence, you know, you still have mission establishments in these places. And Spain referred to these communities, these self-governing communities with councils of indigenous elected officials, as Indian republics. So they were repúblicas de indios, who had their officials and were, you know, kind of self governing, but also semi-autonomous, semi-sovereign. They weren't, you know, fully sovereign in the sense that Spain didn't exercise any control there. Obviously, they exercised a lot of control, and there was a lot of abuse of indigenous peoples, terrible abuse. Then Mexico becomes independent in 1821, and you have a transition where, you know, Mexico goes through a series of liberal reforms, and it had been leading up to this point during the twilight years of the Spanish empire in this hemisphere, where indigenous peoples could become citizens and would become citizens. Well, Mexico sort of did away with that distinction, and through a series of governing documents and constitutional reforms, it's declared that indigenous peoples are citizens of the Republic of Mexico. And if citizens, then entitled to vote and hold office and work at the same professions as anyone else. And so you have this liberalizing spirit within the Mexican Republic. But there are a few things going on under the surface. There are those reformers who perhaps truly are motivated by sort of the liberal spirit of the era, the revolutionary era, you know, where a lot of European states are going through revolutions in the latter part of the 18th century and into the 19th. But then you also have those who want to do away with any kind of distinction or protection that indigenous peoples might have had under Spanish law. So under Spanish law, Spain had recognized indigenous communities and their land, had granted to them portions of their own land, so land grants that were then protected from outsiders, or at least theoretically protected from, you know, sale and alienation. And so Mexico, you know, wants to do away with those distinctions so that then those lands become more open. Mexico also institutes a system of what are called constitutional ayuntamientos, whereby municipalities combine both indigenous communities and non-indigenous neighboring communities into municipal bodies, so that you could have mixed governing bodies, mixed councils, with both indigenous people and non-indigenous people sitting together in those councils and making the governing decisions for those bodies. And you know, there were some officials during the Mexican era who certainly had their eye on indigenous land, who wanted to get their hands on that land. And for some places and areas, the idea wasn't that we will give indigenous people their, you know, rights under the Mexican state. It was, we will compel them and give them obligations where they have to become part of the larger society. We want them to incorporate. And so there's resistance from a lot of these communities that I look at. You know, they don't want to incorporate. They had found a way to sort of coexist under that Spanish system. But a lot of the Spanish system persists, and you still have these governing officials during the Mexican period. So you have governors and sheriffs and lieutenant governors and various officers. So you have sort of almost like a dual system occurring, where you have mixed municipal bodies, but then you still have indigenous governance in their communities. So Mexico isn't really able to do away fully with these Indian republics as they had been constituted under the Spanish realm. So this period is relatively brief, only a couple of decades, until 1846, when the United States comes in a war of conquest and takes a huge portion of what's now the American Southwest. You know, Arizona, New Mexico, parts of California, Utah, Colorado, Texas, you know, all of this territory becomes part of the United States. And then the question becomes, okay, well, what now for all these indigenous communities? Under the treaty that ended the U.S.-Mexico War, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, Mexican citizens could then become U.S. citizens. And well, indigenous peoples in that area had been citizens of the Republic of Mexico. And so by default, they then would become U.S. citizens. But then what actually happens on the ground there is quite different. There are those who don't think indigenous peoples there are ready for citizenship within the United States. There's those who resist that. There are those who say, yes, make them citizens, because then whatever land protections there were previously, again, can be done away with, and this opens up indigenous lands. And the U.S. territorial period during the second half of the 19th century and into the early 20th in Arizona and New Mexico becomes a battleground over the political status of indigenous people. And that's really a question that hadn't been settled for the previous centuries. I mean, that was the thing that Spain was grappling with, and Mexico, and so the United States is grappling with similar issues. But the U.S., their goal obviously becomes assimilation and incorporation of indigenous people, so that, like you said earlier, erasure is the ultimate goal. You know, assimilation is just another way of erasing distinct indigenous cultures and getting them out of the way, opening their lands for settlement, for incorporation by the nation state. So that's kind of what happens there. It's a very broad summary of kind of the colonial programs. But again, it's always dependent on the specific community, because what they experience in Pueblo communities in New Mexico is not necessarily what Yaqui communities in southern Arizona in the early part of the 20th century experience. And so there's always variation, and kind of underscores that idea of there's never a one-size-fits-all colonial program, as much as colonial nation states, colonizers want to have a one-size-fits-all program. It never pans out that way. And each community resists or accommodates or blends and indigenizes in its own way. And it's fascinating to see how that plays out in those various communities and the methods of resistance or accommodation that they incorporate. And that's that's what drives the narrative of my book. It's seeing these different groups and putting them in conversation with each other so that you can see the variation in that comparative nature, but then also seeing how they survive and how they persist and how they deal with colonizers.
Absolutely. And, you know, your book follows a periodization that kind of divides it by these different colonial regimes. But, you know, a theme that really comes out is the long internal political traditions of each of these groups and continuity across multiple generations, in this case, centuries, as these politically astute communities engage with different colonial regimes. And it seems as if there's kind of two ends of the spectrum. On one end, you have the Hopis, and on the other end, perhaps you have the Yaquis, in terms of their the degree to which they interact with the settler state in an attempt to maintain their autonomy. And so could you talk a little bit about the continuities in those approaches and how and why you think they respond so differently to these colonial regimes?
Sure. Yeah, so of course, I look at four different groups, and even within those larger groups, you know, they break down significantly as well into to different communities. So it's hard to characterize them as, you know, four groups when there's so much variation. We're talking about, if I say the Pueblos of New Mexico, we're talking about what is today 19 indigenous nations, but historically was scores of indigenous nations in New Mexico and through a process of you know, disruption and depopulation and you know, moving and migration of different groups. You have them coalescing into to the communities that there are today. And so I just want to say that, first of all, that we're talking about many nations here, many, many nations here, an infinity of nations, if we put it that way. But kind of speaking broadly, you have different approaches, and you kind of, like you said, there's some extremes there. Hopis in what's now northern Arizona are characterized by, at least within the colonial setting, isolation. Hopi is a series of mesas. They are geographically sort of isolated from other communities. I mean, the nearest communities now are Zuni, and it's within the larger Navajo Nation. The Hopi Reservation today is situated inside, surrounded by the Navajo Nation. But historically, they're isolated from colonial seats of power. And the Kingdom of New Mexico in the 17th century, let's say, the colonial seat is in Santa Fe, which is quite a distance from the Hopi mesas. And so for Spain to exercise any sort of colonial dominion over Hopi is a significant undertaking, because it's so far, and to get the people there, to get the manpower to really control those communities, it's quite difficult. You have Hopi missionization in the 17th century for several decades, but they're struggling because of that isolation and not having the manpower. And so you see this this interaction between Hopis and Franciscan missionaries there, and things do not always go smoothly. The Franciscans, you know, are as with any mission communities, they're constantly frustrated by the resistance shown by the Hopis who are living there, but they're trying to keep them under control and force, you know, Spanish norms of governance and religion and culture onto these people. But Hopis are able to just resist this and remove that influence. You know, after the Pueblo Revolt in 1680, which Hopis are part of, Spain then tries to come back to the mesas after they'd been expelled in 1680, in the latter part of the 1690s and into 1700. And it looks like they're going to reestablish mission communities there. But Hopis beat them back, and at the cost of violence against some of their own people at a place like Owatavie. But I think that it has to do not necessarily with, you know, I don't want to essentialize people and say, you know, they have this certain character, but a combination of the location, the difficulty in colonizing there, that Hopis are able to beat back the forces of colonization. And after 1700, it's not until well into the second half of the 19th century that more, you know, missions and colonial establishments during the U.S. territorial period are set up at Hopi, because Mexico doesn't really have a presence in Hopi territory, and the U.S. doesn't for quite a while either. And for, you know, 100+ years, neither does Spain in the second half of their period of colonial dominion in New Mexico. And so Hopis are an interesting case there and have resisted that colonization in a variety of ways. Then on the other extreme, you have Yaquis, who are in what is today Sonora and along the Yaqui River. They are missionized in the first half of the 17th century and through the Jesuit order, and they set up these missions there. And those who are involved in this missionizing effort and the, you know, chronicling what has happened there, you know, comment on how Yaquis come in and form these 8 principal communities and say, you know, it's remarkable how easily they were reduced into these communities and they were anxious to have us there. And Yaquis obviously are understanding this in different ways, in a variety of ways. But they do coalesce around some of these larger communities along the Rio Yaqui and incorporate Spanish forms of governance, but also indigenize those so that there are very strong Yaqui components as well. But the mission establishments are there, and Yaquis have these institutions of governance. They have their elections. They have their officers. But they're always at odds with colonial Spain on the degree of control. And they sort of, if you were to summarize, you know, this, if there were some conversation that was had, it was Yaquis saying, you know, like, okay, we did these things. Now leave us to have the internal control that these institutions should allow. Let us choose our elected officials. Let us govern our communities. And Spain, and in particular the Jesuit friars who are there, are very reluctant to do that. You know, they still want to have ultimate control over these things. And so they start meddling in elections. They start expelling officers. They start, you know, not allowing Yaquis to work where they want to work. And so this begins a period in which Yaquis and colonial Spain and then Mexico are frequently at war. And with Yaquis, there are many wars fought against the colonial powers of Spain and then Mexico, which ultimately Mexico seeks extermination of Yaquis. I mean, they just want to get rid of them. And so there's a Yaqui diaspora where Yaquis move to different places and often have to hide their identity for fear of death. It's a very real danger that they will be killed. And so you have Yaqui communities in places like Hermosillo, and this is how Yaquis end up in southern Arizona in the latter part of the 19th and into the early 20th century. So Yaquis have this very different relationship, which is, it's ironic because they institute these changes and these forms of governance, and yet then they're the ones who are at war, and it's characterized by so much violence against both Spain and Mexico. So that's something that's going on there. And then with the Pueblos of New Mexico, beginning in 1698, that's the, or 1598, that's the first permanent settlement, of New Mexico by settlers and representatives of Spain. The Pueblos also have a history of violent encounters with these colonizers, and they're are many abuses, but at the Pueblos, you see the establishment of these forms of governance with Spanish officials. The Pueblos indigenize a lot of these institutions, and instead of an election where, you know, an electorate of voters go and vote in the officials. You have the choosing of officials by religious leaders in that community who get together and have this discussion and choose who will be the Spanish officials for that year, the governor and lieutenant governor and fiscales and the other officers. And so you have that indigenization that's going on, and that they reach a way of sort of making that system work so that you retain the religious leadership of the pueblos, but then you also have the Spanish officials who provide the front that interacts with the colonial nation state, so that the traditions and the religious life of the community can still stay intact and sort of be protected with that, with those Spanish officials interacting with colonial authorities and religious authorities as well. So that's a kind of a summary of these groups. So we've got Hopis, I talked about, and then Tonautums. So in what is now Southern Arizona and Northern Sonora around that US-Mexico border, you have this group of Autumn people. And again, we're talking about various groups, and I sort of concentrate on eventually what will become Tonautums in that region. And, you know, they're sort of in the middle between accommodation and resistance and violence. They also incorporate these forms of electoral politics at their missions, but Spain always has trouble populating those missions with resident friars. And so you have extended periods where priests aren't there. And so these communities are both doing their own thing, but then also implementing some of those colonial mandates. And that persists into the Mexican period, where a lot of those missions are abandoned, essentially. And then the United States comes in there and has those same questions of, okay, what do we do with these people? What's their political status? And there are some designs at making them U.S. citizens through processes like allotment and severalty. So this San Javier del Bac mission, which is a reservation, a U.S. reservation, is then allotted, which would then entail citizenship through that allotment process through, you know, the Dawes Act. But it doesn't pan out like the United States has envisioned. And, people living on individual allotments, you know, doesn't really equate and doesn't correspond with traditional life ways there. And so that path to citizenship doesn't pan out. But that's kind of how these four groups encounter the colonial states and sort of a rough summary of how they interact with those colonial nation states. So it ranges from accommodation to violence, resistance, through partial accommodation and just sort of only doing the bare minimum to sort of keep the colonizers at arm's length as much as possible. But what you don't see is, what I didn't see really was, we're going to do all the colonizer says and play the colonizer's game because it'll work out in our favor. You don't see that in these communities. They are politically savvy. They're saying, okay, what will benefit us materially, politically, and demonstrably, and what will not? And they learn and they know and they understand in these communities, look, this doesn't help us. This won't help us. And so that's why in a number of these communities in the 19th and 20th century, when the United States says, okay, now it's time for you to become citizens and become enfranchised, in a lot of these places, they say, no, we don't want that, because through past experience, we know that this will not help us. We have done what we want to do. We've made the changes we want to make, but we want to retain our internal governments and citizenship and incorporation into the body politic of the United States in the early part of the 20th century isn't a good solution. And I think a lot of these communities recognize that.
Thank you for that overview of all of them. And I think, you know, you describe Indigenous history as a quote, extraordinary confluence of stories. And I really think you see how, you know, these various colonial regimes, you know, and these Native communities, you know, come together, create new stories as these Natives seek to adapt, hybridize, resist in all of these different ways. And I wonder, as you survey, you know, as you step back and look at this long history that you've outlined and you survey these various strategies used to challenge and subvert colonial power, you know, are there any lessons that can be learned, you know, with regard to what engagement with the settler state can or cannot accomplish?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are a lot of important lessons. One takeaway I would say, and this kind of harkens back to my introduction in the book and that discussion, is that I think that it is very difficult to look to the nation state for sovereignty, right? So, I mean, sovereignty is inherent. And Indigenous nations, by virtue of being nations, have inherent sovereignty and should have all of the autonomy and you know, conceptions of rights of citizens, all those things. Those are within those Indigenous nations. What I'm getting at is it's difficult to then say, you know, we should be voting in people who then will help us secure our rights. You know, is the strategy instead to look to our own communities, focus inward, focus on sovereignty, make sovereignty, you know, operative and in action in all that we do. It's difficult because, you know, you have a series of things like treaties and court decisions and congressional actions and all these things which limit and define and seek to dictate to tribal nations what their sovereignty entails and what it means. And so the conundrum that I'm getting at, the ultimate conundrum is sovereignty to be found within the political institutions of the settler colonial state? I think the ultimate answer to that is no, it's not. Does that mean that Indigenous people shouldn't participate in electoral politics in you know, the state or territory or nation within which they're situated more broadly? Should we not vote in U.S. elections? Should we not participate in Arizona elections or whatnot? Not necessarily, but I think that the real lesson and the ultimate takeaway is that sovereignty, Indigenous liberation, I don't think are ultimately to be found within those institutions. Because if they were, then that, you know, triumphalist narrative would hold true, wouldn't it? That through a series of court actions and you know, civil rights struggles of Indigenous people, that we finally arrive at that promised land where we want to be. And I don't think that that's a reality. And so I'm not necessarily proposing an ultimate strategy, but I am questioning whether electoral politics and enfranchisement within the settler colonial state is the solution. And I think that should come across in my book, because all of these tribal nations are, you know, both trying that method, but then resisting that method. And you see that different things work at different times. But I guess beyond the book, I would say the ultimate lesson is, how do we conceive of sovereignty? How do we fight for Indigenous liberation? Is it through the political institutions like Congress and the Supreme Court and those things? Or is it ultimately through our own Indigenous nations and our own community building that we do? And I think it's It's going to be more the latter. I don't know exactly what that looks like. And I think that, you know, indigenous political theorists are envisioning what that future will be. And as we speak, and that's an exciting body of literature and those developments. But that's not to say that other people who have different visions of how to accomplish and how to reach true sovereignty and self-determination, that their ideas are necessarily wrong. You know, some tribal nations are going to pursue it through economic activity, through wielding economic power. Then tribal nations can exert the type of political power that they want, or through getting tribal indigenous people in seats of power within the United States or within the individual state, that they can then affect policy and lawmaking. You know, many people see those as legitimate avenues, but I would say that ultimately, again, we need to look to our own communities and try to put sovereignty into action, and that, you know, often leads to conflict and struggle, but that's what we need is indigenous liberation ultimately.
And one tool that seems to be used throughout the book, one theme is the idea of refusal. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you use that concept and how it shows up in the book. I'll just leave it a general question like that.
Yeah, sure. Refusal as a political tool, I think, is really important. And there are indigenous roots to that. It's funny, and this isn't in my book, but if you look at, like, for example, the Indian Reorganization Act in the 1930s, when, you know, Collier envisions tribal referenda that will decide whether a tribe accepts reorganization or not. And in a lot of communities, the turnout is extremely low. And you only have a handful of people go, and maybe the majority does vote for reorganization. And the United States, you know, the BIA considers not going and voting a vote in the affirmative, when the reality is indigenous people, for many indigenous communities and nations, non-participation means disapproval. It means not approving of the measure. And so it kind of harkens to this idea of refusal, that through not accepting, you know, the quote-unquote gifts of the colonizers and the rights of the colonizers and all of their institutions and all these things, you know, they always are making these promises when they come, saying, we will guide you in the arts of civilization. We'll give you all of these wonderful things that we have. And throughout, you just see indigenous refusal. Like, we don't want those things. And sometimes it's explicit. Sometimes it's within the, like, for example, with the case of the Pueblos in the latter 19th and early 20th century, they clearly articulate this stance. We do not want to be citizens. We don't want citizenship from the United States, but in other places it's not so explicit. It's just an act of not showing up. It's an act of not accepting. It's an act of not doing, and that's a form of resistance. I mean, refusal is an indigenous strategy that, like I said, is rooted in that. By not participating, by not going and being part of something, you are voicing your disapproval of it. And so you see that in these indigenous communities time and again. And I think that characterizes one of the major themes of the book and of indigenous resistance to the settler colonial project. It's that, look, we don't want your ideas of civilization and citizenship and voting, they don't appeal to us. We have forms of governance. We have what we need. And then sometimes, okay, well, we'll do the minimum. We'll do these things like you say, because we want to, again, keep you at arm's length and keep you away from our community so that we can be self-determining and sovereign as much as possible. But colonial officials are often baffled by that. You know, like, I can't understand why people are not flocking to the polls, or why individuals aren't accepting their allotments and severalty. Why aren't they going there and farming their land happily? We've extended to them all of these things. And the answer is, through refusal, they are voicing their own political autonomy, their faith in their own indigenous political institutions and life ways, really, cultural norms. But you see that in so many cases, and I always love seeing the statements by colonial officials who just don't get it. They can't understand, why wouldn't you want these things? And it's because the title of the book comes from Benavides, who says these people have always been a republic. They've always had a government. They've always seen to their needs. One person who at least in some way kind of understood, indigenous communities have always had what they needed and wanted, and will, make changes and incorporate different elements as they see fit, but they will always be indigenous nations, indigenous republics, indigenous, whatever you want to call it. Hope that answers your question.
Absolutely. In the introduction to the book, you talk about the power of stories, stories to help indigenous peoples make sense of their existence, to counter and subvert hegemonic narratives. And I wonder, could you talk about, your audience for this book, what you hope this story can add to the world, but also to historians of American Indian history or borderlands or American history more generally? How can they benefit from the perspective that you outline in this book, and ideally go buy the book?
Sure. Well, I would hope that as wide a readership as possible would read this. That isn't just a handful of people and family members who buy it because they're excited that I wrote a book. I would envision this being read by both college students, graduate students, and a broader public readership interested in the history of indigenous peoples, and especially right now when we're having these discussions about people of color and their place within the United States, the politics of inclusion and what all of this means. I think that this is the type of book that can help individuals understand the position and how indigenous communities see themselves within this broader landscape, and how there's a long history of interaction with colonial states, and that the United States is just sort of the newest kid on the block in that sense, and that communities of color, but particularly indigenous communities, have been interacting and trying to make sense of this relationship for a long, long time. And so if we look at this political moment right now, with George Floyd and African-American communities, and then larger communities of color and indigenous communities, what is this relationship? What does it mean? And so I think that the book speaks to that. I think that in particular, it will help with conceiving of what it means to live in a borderlands where, borders are shifting, the position of the nation state is always sort of tenuous, and that exerting colonial control is very much sort of a give and take, and indigenous communities are doing as much dictating as they can of the terms of that relationship. So that in that Southwest borderlands there, you really see how indigenous communities can and do subvert colonial power and do, in many ways, exercise power over the colonizers to the point of outright revolt. In New Mexico, during the Rio Arriba revolt, you have indigenous peoples with Nuevo Mexicano and Genisoro allies killing the governor and establishing their own state. And so it's I think it's useful to help maybe people understand that power is always elusive, that it's ephemeral, that it comes and goes, and that we can't conceive of these places as sites where power is held and exercised, and the settler state is always in control. That's not the case, and that it often happens sort of at the borders, where both geopolitical borders, but also boundaries of culture, of religion, all of these things are fluctuating, and they're moving, they're in motion. And they're ephemeral. I think that's the best way to describe, the best word to describe them. I think that it's useful to people who are trying to understand, what that means in a borderland setting. I think that's good on that regard.
Thank you for that. And I think the book is a wonderful contribution, and thank you for writing it. Can you talk a little bit as we close here about what you're working on now and where you're taking the work that you've previously done?
Absolutely. The book that I wrote was, like you said, is very broad, and it covers a long both chronology and geography. And I guess I'm transitioning to a more concentrated history and looking at a smaller area for a shorter duration. A lot of historians kind of do the opposite. They write a sort of very specific smaller history and then go to something more broad. And I'm maybe kind of inverting that. But taking those concepts of indigenous resistance and indigenous peoples and communities trying and exercising sovereignty as much as possible. I'm looking next. I've already begun research and writing, looking at my own people, looking at Yavapai and Dilje, Western Apache peoples, and specifically, I'm looking at scouts. So it was common in during the so-called Indian Wars in Arizona, the Apache Wars, for Yavapai and Western Apache people, men, to engage in scouting. That it was an acceptable activity, and so they scouted for the U.S. Army against other indigenous groups. And so, what I want to look at is after those so-called Indian Wars are finished, after reservations have been established in Arizona, what former scouts do in and for their communities. And this was inspired by looking at some of my own history. I've already been involved in some writing about Yavapai and Yavapai Apache history. And there are certain themes that kept emerging when I was talking to community members and elders and looking at documents, that certain names kept popping up, and they were often people who had been scouts. They were men who had served as scouts for the army. And what I've found is that they make an important contributions. They make an important contribution to their communities because they have experience with the bureaucratic side of, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the U.S. Army, and experience with, the United States. And so they're able to use that knowledge leverage it for the benefit of their communities. And a lot of scouts receive land bounties for their service. So they're given land that then becomes part of the center of the what becomes a reservation. That happened in my tribe. They also receive scout pensions, which during the early part of the 20th century, and it was a very difficult time, and we look at population figures for indigenous communities, they're at their lowest, and this is when that money and that land and that knowledge really helps those communities survive. And so you see scouts former scouts doing a lot of this work and doing a lot of the heavy lifting and going to Washington, D.C. and interacting with the bureaucracy because of that experience gained during the Indian Wars. So I'm not interested in the Indian Wars themselves. I'm not interested in the battles and the fighting and all of that. What I'm interested in is, after all of that's over, what do these individuals do? How do they benefit their communities? How do they use whatever experiences and knowledge that they've gained to then help these communities survive at a very, very difficult time during the reservation era? And I'm specifically looking at Yavapais and Dilje, Western Apaches, who are my people.
Wonderful. Well, it'll be fascinating to see how the themes and strategies that you explore at a tribal level show up and play out at an individual level with that exploration.
Yeah, great.
We look forward to it. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's been a good experience. I've enjoyed it.
Maurice Crandall is a historian and professor of Native American Studies at Dartmouth College. His new book is These People Have Always Been a Republic, Indigenous Electorates in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands, 1598 to 1912, and it is available now from the University of North Carolina Press.